Anything worth saying is worth talking about. Deprogram with Michael Parker on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Free thinkers, good people, how's it going? It's Michael Parker. It is the second hour of Deprogram here on TNT. I'm your host, Michael Parker. I'm going to be joined in just a moment by Daniel Martinez. He is a U.S. congressional candidate here in California, and he's running as Republican, which is a tough road to hoe, but we're going to talk about that. And before we get to that, I've got a article I want to run past you guys, because here in Los Angeles, we can't come up with enough bad ideas fast enough. We're trying to find new and innovative ways to come up with more worthless ideas all the time. So today I found this thing. There is one of our local city council people, this guy named Paul Koretz. His big idea is, you know what we're going to do? We're going to combat climate change by banning gas stations. You heard me right. That's what we're going to do. We're going to make it where you can't build any more gas stations. So as ridiculous as that sounds, this is true. So I'm trying to remember where I found this today. It might have been on Fox. I'm not sure. But regardless, here's the deal. It says Los Angeles may ban new gas stations to help combat climate emergency. LA could become the largest city to prohibit the construction of new gas stations, joining a movement that seeks to limit fossil fuels at the local level as part of efforts to combat the climate crisis. He goes on to say, this is what Paul says, good old Paul. He says, quote, "We are ending oil drilling in Los Angeles. We are moving to all electric new construction, and we are building towards fossil free transportation." Now, this is an LA city council guy. Okay, so a couple of things here. Los Angeles, like most cities, we already have a lot of gas stations. I'm not concerned that not building new gas stations is going to create a huge problem, but just the idea that they could tell you, no, we're not going to build any more gas stations. What they're really telling you is that you have no choice here. You're going to, whether you want to have a gasoline or diesel powered vehicle versus an electric vehicle or no vehicle, that's no longer your choice. We're just going to cut off your access to gasoline, although this is, I don't really think this will happen. But what I'm saying is the message that they're really sending is, we're doing this whether you like it or not. And this proposal was inspired by a city called Petaluma, which I think is in Northern California. They are a Bay Area city council, voted unanimously in support of this measure, and they cited Petaluma's commitment to becoming carbon neutral by 2030. So Gavin Newsom as well, you know, he's fully on board with this. We're all going to drive electric cars. And as we save the world from fossil fuels, we're not counting in the factor of the gigantic amount of mining that likely will be done in third world countries by people under harsh, really no human rights. Because you know what it takes to build the batteries for these cars? You need lithium, you need cobalt, you need manganese, you need zinc. And there's the reason they're called rare earth minerals. You have to excavate gigantic amounts of earth in order to derive these elements that go into the making of these batteries. So while we virtue signal here in the U.S. by talking about not building any gasoline stations, meanwhile, we're going to offshore the business of finding these minerals for electric vehicles into third world countries where kids and people with no human rights, paid very poor wages, are going to excavate the earth and create God knows what kind of ecological damage in those areas. But anyway, so I just point this out because it's completely ridiculous. And this campaign is known as the Safe Cities Movement. And it's backed by some environmental nonprofit called Stand.Earth. And at the end of the day, listen, we are all environmentalists. We all want the earth to be maintained. I'm not saying that we continue to pollute. I'm saying, you know, we should be good stewards of our planet, but we need to be realistic in the efforts that we're going to take in order to get to the future. And ideas of banning gas stations, that's just like the thing earlier where I said Biden wants to ban nicotine and cigarettes. This is just pointing at an industry, you know, telling them to do something, fix something, while he doesn't do anything, and maybe a net zero. So I don't know. It just irks me no end. And in California, it seems like we are the first to adopt bad ideas, and we are kind of the litmus test for, well, if we can make this happen here, then we will spread it throughout the U.S. So I don't know if this is going to happen, but this is coming from a city council person here in Los Angeles who I don't think that he's really speaking for that many people when he talks about getting rid of gas stations. This is TNT. We'll be right back with Daniel Martinez.
Gaining perspectives.
It's well-balanced conversation.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
All right, folks. So this is our second hour of the program. I'm speaking with Daniel Martinez. He is a U.S. congressional candidate for Congress. And good morning, Daniel. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
I was listening to your interview with Jim Breslow yesterday and learning about you, and you came to us highly recommended by some friends of the show, and you are running as a Republican. And tell us about your District 31, what that is. I think you have like 750,000 people in that area. What constitutes your district?
So it's about 12 miles east of Los Angeles proper, from Monrovia to San Dimas Laverne along the 210 freeway, and then down south to just past the 10 freeway covering El Monte.
Well, you are clearly moving on to the main election in November. We just had a primary here June 7th, and we didn't have great turnout yet again, which is disappointing. I thought it would be better than it was. I wasn't expecting a lot. As far as I know, I think we may still be counting votes here in Los Angeles County.
Officially, yes, they are. The vote's not set to be certified for another 20 some odd days.
Okay, so Daniel, I'm going to start right off with that then. That's a concern that I have. And a lot of well-meaning, very intelligent people come on my show. And I'll just say it so they don't have to say it. I have one of my greatest concerns is electoral integrity. And I don't think that it's wild and crazy conspiracy theory. I think there's been problems with elections for decades, if not, you know, more than decades. And so that is my concern, because everybody talks about, oh, there's going to be a big red wave in November. Well, maybe, but I'm not convinced of that. And I use this as an example. So we just had this election, and at the end of the day, at the end of that election day, the mayoral candidate here in LA with the most votes was Rick Caruso. And the DNC favorite, Karen Bass, came in about, I think, 4 to 6 percentage points behind. Long story short, as we go through these numerous days of counting votes, she has surpassed him. And I don't want to be cynical, but I think anybody could have seen that coming. So I use this just as an example of, I mean, maybe all of those votes are legit. I don't know. We had this low turnout. Who knows? But that concerns me. And I think that Republicans are going to have to push back on this type of thing. But you have the floor. Speak to electoral integrity.
Yeah, I like to open up this topic by going back to when I was a kid and watching The Simpsons. And The Simpsons would routinely discuss dead people voting in elections, right?
Yep.
Like, there's a certain amount of election shenanigans that have gone back since the beginning of time.
Yeah.
It's a natural byproduct of having an entirely secret ballot. The only way you're really going to eliminate election meddling is if you had a ballot that had complete independent verification after the fact. You had something equivalent to when you go to your ATM machine, getting a receipt afterwards with an identifiable transaction code that can then be double checked later on in the future. I do caution overly focusing on this issue, because one of the problems that I deal with when I'm going and speaking to members in my district, especially more conservative members, is the belief that because of the shenanigans that have taken place in the past, there's no point in voting in the present. And you run the risk of creating a self-fulfilling hypothesis and artificially depressing your own turnout. And that is something that we need to be concerned of. The in the present, the goal, I mean, the necessity to tighten the tighten election integrity is to send people with integrity into office so they can tighten the system. And the way that you're going to do that is assume in your mind that there's some certain percentage of shenanigans that take place. And we need overwhelming support to make sure that, like similar in 2016, to make sure that you can't, that they can't pull that card when they're counting the numbers.
Well, and listen, I agree with you 100%, and I've made that point time and time again here. So I'm not encouraging anybody sit this out. As a matter of fact, I know people that sit this out for the cynicism that you are describing. So I'm not, I vote. What, you know, so I don't want you to think that that's what I'm saying, but I am still concerned. And, listen, I wish you well in this election, and the fact that you're going to the actual election, I don't know did you have to primary against any, I know that you're up against a elderly candidate, who's probably been in office a bazillion years. Was there anybody else in your race?
I was six. She was born 6 years before World War II, for context. And there was one other person in the race. It was another Democrat by the name of Rocco DeLuca. He's a nice guy. We've actually become fairly good friends, and he's going to vote for me and endorse me later on throughout the summer because he was treated absolutely atrociously by the Democratic Party.
I can't imagine that.
Yeah, he's a nice guy. He came into it with the good intentions. His basic story was he's a project manager for a construction team, and 20 years ago he made about half the money he makes today, but had more buying power. Yeah. And some of the new kids he's hiring are making roughly the same dollar amount that he was when he started, and he just can't imagine how they can survive. And so his intention was to, replace the 86-year-old incumbent with somebody who was willing to look for common sense ideas and work across the aisle to actually bring some relief and some sanity in our economic system. And when he presented that at the local San Gabriel Valley Democratic organizational meeting, they scolded him and ran him out because he mentioned that he wanted to work across the aisle with the other side to come up with solutions. They literally said, do you have any idea? Like, you do realize you're running as a Democrat, right? We don't do those things here. And so now he's on our side.
That is not helpful. That is not helpful.
It's atrocious. Yeah.
And I was being sarcastic when I said, come on, because I fully expect that the establishment candidate is going to have the full support of the DNC and treat this man badly. But anyway, you're fighting a good fight. You're out there in the trenches doing this. I want to talk about a couple of issues. You might have heard my introduction having to do with gas stations. And we talk about energy on this show a lot because, listen, we've got more issues happening simultaneously than I remember in a long time, if not ever, and I'm no spring chicken. So inflation, energy, war in Ukraine, border crisis, homelessness, drug addiction, substance abuse, COVID. But to me, it almost always starts with the economy, right? Is the economy stupid? So talk to me about energy. Especially energy as it's related to California, because they're talking about this, you know, gas tax holiday. I don't think they understand that we pay typically $1.30 extra per gallon in California for fees and taxes. I could rant on, but I want to give you the floor. I'm sorry. I'm rambling.
Yeah, no problem. No problem. And thank you very much for the opportunity. If I can make a more general observation that I've noticed is,
please,
it seems that we're run by the people have been running our country for the past, if we looked at it for the past 20 or 30 years, they don't seem to have any, they barely have a 6-year plan. They don't seem to have any 60-year plan, and they don't seem to have any comprehension of the reasons why it's necessary to have a 600-year plan for a country. And I open with that because a lot of our energy issues need to be discussed at least on a multi-century plan. Every country, when you're you need water, you need food, you need energy. These are the lifebloods of every economy. And these are not just economic issues. They're national security issues.
I want to interrupt.
Started over.
Yes. I want to interrupt for just a second. They would argue, Daniel, that our 600-year policy is this climate change issue, and that they would, you know, they would fight on that hill. But I just want to throw that in there. Continue.
Yeah, no, I mean, but if we were talking about a 600-year policy with regards to weaning ourselves off fossil fuels, we could actually have an intelligent conversation about this. That's not, yes. It's not something that we should shy away from.
Right.
Decreasing our dependence on countries like Russia and countries like Iran and countries like Venezuela, countries like Saudi Arabia, that are authoritarian regimes that share very few of our values, is a good thing in the long term.
Yes.
The question is, how do you go about accomplishing that goal? So when I went into the numbers, so there's a new modular nuclear power plant that's in process of being constructed in Utah. And it's coming in at a cost of about $5 billion. And so I crunched some numbers to look at the total, the total energy that the US currently gets from fossil fuels, and how many of those plants we would need to construct to be able to completely wean off of fossil fuel with nuclear, right? Meaning a reliable backup plan that's not dependent on weather changes. And we need something like 2 million of them. The numbers are astronomical. So even if your goal was to completely wean off of oil and gas, and let's assume that that's, for the purpose of this argument, let's assume that that's mm-hmm. necessary to achieve the long-term goals of climate change. Let's concede that point for right now. Just yes. on a practical basis, it would take 100 years to construct the first percent of the ones that we need. And hopefully an economy of scale could be formed around this over time that would lower the cost and lower the amount of time that it would take to construct. But assuming that their thesis is correct, there's still no practical path to get to that point by 2030, for example. Like grounding airplanes is just insane. And the reality is that as long as, and this has just been true throughout the industrial age, as long as energy is a necessity, a lifeblood of not just the local economy, but the national security, we have to have a reliable energy source as a bridge to get to whatever that next stage of energy production actually is. And to get to your point earlier, legislatively determining that we won't use this path, this particular type of fuel, is just short-sighted. California is a natural gas desert. We don't have natural gas pipelines that connect us to any of the underlying infrastructure. Everything we get has to be piped in. The California in Sacramento, they've already passed legislation to make it that any construction after some point in the 2030s, residential construction, cannot even have natural gas piped into the house. It has to be entirely electrical, based off of an idea that somehow in the next 10 years we're going to get sufficient solar power up and running to be able to completely fuel this magical utopian future that they envision, even though we don't actually produce solar panels and those component parts here in the United States. There's not a single solar panel that exists here some component of it doesn't flow through the Chinese supply line.
Right. I want to make sure I just understood one part of what you just said, because we do produce oil in California, although they want to stop that entirely. When you were talking about natural gas, because I grew up in the oil business, and typically when you're producing oil, a lot of times you will also get natural gas. Did I hear you right when you were saying there's no natural gas in California?
No, that there's no pipeline that we don't have a right. pipeline to be able to connect right. natural gas out, to import natural gas from other parts of the United States. That's what I was referring to.
Copy that. Okay.
We're an island, yeah. And what we have produce here is the only thing that we have. Otherwise, we have to get it by boat.
Understood. So, the point that you're making, Renette Senham was on the show several days ago, or maybe it was last week, and we had a similar conversation because she started, you know, she started out as an environmentalist. And as I always say, we're all environmentalists. We all want to be better stewards of the planet, but we need to have some realism in this conversation. So when you talk about renewables, whether it be solar or wind, or you talk about nuclear energy, there's also the period of time that's involved in the creation of those tools, and they're not counting that in. And also with solar and wind, you have to have redundant systems in case, you know, you have a cloudy day or there's not enough wind. So you still have to have these fossil fuel products. So I don't know, right now with the price of gas and the diesel additives that people are talking about, all of these issues putting an additional crunch on the economy and inflation, I think this is one of the most important things that we have to discuss, especially in the state of California, where people are paying $6.50 a gallon.
Oh, absolutely. And this is also where our lack of foresight, right? Our lack of the 60-year plan, the 600-year plan, mixed into our national and international foreign policy is absolutely problematic, right? Like the net result of the sanctions that we've imposed on Russia vis-a-vis the conflict in Ukraine have, as you alluded to earlier, created a situation where India and China are purchasing oil at a roughly 30% discount to what the United States and what individuals in California are paying for their fuel. That's put us at a strategic disadvantage globally. And there doesn't seem to be any rationality or consistency with regards to the foreign policy decisions that we're making. We went hat in hand to Venezuela to try to have them bail us out of this mess, just to realize that their oil industry has been destroyed by cronyism and socialism, and their output is down 90% in the past 20 years. So they're not going to be able to bail us out. Not to mention that if we're going to Venezuela so we can make a moral stance against Russia, we have to sacrifice our moral stance to be able to make inroads with Venezuela. And we're doing the same thing with Saudi Arabia. Yeah. And the Biden administration entered office with a claim of moral superiority against MBS for killing Khashoggi. And MBS's attitude with us was, if you don't want to deal with me, I'm the dictatorial ruler of this country. I will bring economic pain to you through the tools that I have, which is being the autocrat of a petrostate. And we've put ourselves in a situation. And then when you, especially if you couple that with the canceling of the Keystone Pipeline and clearly setting the tone for our domestic energy production, that if you do make the multi-billion dollar investments that you would need to be able to raise domestic production to the level that you could offset our dependence from these autocratic regimes, that in 10 years or in 5 years, the regulatory scheme that will come down on you will make it so those investments are not worthwhile. So the oil and gas industry sitting on their hands. Yeah.
Daniel, I got to take a quick break. I'll speak with Daniel Martinez. He is running for U.S. congressional candidate here in his District 31. This is TNT. My name is Michael Parker. We got to take a quick break and we'll be right back.
The common housefly, caught in the clutches of the spider's web. Every move it makes just makes matters worse. Then, dinner time.
Feast on the captivating stories, videos, and helpful information on our website.
Whoa. Dinner's ready.
Oh, man.
Escape is futile.
Just one more video.
Get stuck in our web.
TNTRadio.live.
The 2020 election was the most secure in U.S. history.
There has been no evidence of widespread voter fraud.
He lost a fair and secure election.
Most secure election in American history.
Really?
All those of you who volunteered and worked the polls, you deserve a special thanks from the entire nation.
This one mule made 53 trips to 20 drop boxes. He's not alone. We tracked 2,000 mules making multiple ballot drops. Leaving no fingerprints. Snapping photos to get paid. A coordinated ring of illegal vote harvesting in all the key states where the election was decided.
They've delivered us a clear victory.
Game over.
Stream at Salem Now or Locals.
Mainstream media censors, smears, and intimidates those telling the truth.
We mandate that the truth be told.
Today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
We're back. This is Deprogram. I'm your host, Michael Parker. I'm speaking with U.S. Congressional candidate Daniel Martinez. We were talking about energy. We got a lot to go over, so I'm probably going to tie off on that. But yes, Daniel agrees, like we all agree, our energy policy is going to have to take a cold shower and wake up really quickly, because this is not working. And one of the things that we could do is increase domestic production. It really is crucial. And that's a big part of why we're in the bind that we're in now. And you don't have to be Nostradamus to have seen that coming. Daniel, I want to move on to some other things as well. In the next hour, I'm going to have some Ukrainian filmmakers come on, and we're going to talk about a new film and that they, a documentary, or actually it's a fiction film, but the issues in Ukraine, I want to get your take on this. I don't see this war being sustainable. I mentioned a month or so ago after the Davos thing, this is just my spidey senses, Henry Kissinger, who was going to be 99 years old in like 3 days, had this comment to say at Davos, which was that he felt like Ukraine would have to yield some territory to Russia. Now, I know people don't like that idea. My interpretation of that was, this is almost predictive programming. You know, let's let the old guy put this out there. Your take on Ukraine and what you think is going to happen, because now we got a situation as well where Lithuania is blocking the railway for Russia to the sea. So I see, even if this winds down, we may have another issue now vis-a-vis Lithuania. But your thoughts?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to be attending the Night for Ukraine screening.
Oh, excellent. I'll meet you tonight.
Yes. So, oh, beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. But this also ties into the my little spiel at the opening about us lacking a 6-year plan, a 60-year plan, a 600-year plan. So just for the record, my wife was born in Moscow. Her father was born in Ukraine. So she has family on both sides of the border that mm-hmm. are hundreds of kilometers apart, not thousands of kilometers apart. And it's important to keep historical perspective of what's going on in the present. It didn't happen isolated in a vacuum. Like before the present issues, we had the 2014 annexation of Crimea. And before that, we had the invasion of Georgia that immediately followed Georgia's publicly stated intention to join NATO. And since then, they haven't joined NATO because the amount of territory they lost in that war included all but one of their ports that accessed the Black Sea. And before Georgia, there was Chechnya. So Russia and Putin specifically have been engaging in a fairly predictable pattern and strategy through the region, if you look at it through the prism of 20 years.
Yes.
And one of the, and again, I have, like, my wife has family on both sides of this. So I wish nothing more than to minimize the suffering for the individual people there, and the destruction of the infrastructure is absolutely atrocious. But just wishing those things to go away does not mean that everything that the United States has done from a foreign policy standpoint has been remotely rational. I've gone deep into this issue because of the personal connection with my wife, but also Russia has 6,000 nuclear weapons. And that's not something that can be forgotten in our relationship, in our relationship with them. Kamala Harris spoke about this issue a few weeks ago, and she was referring to sanctions as similar to what a parent does to a child. When the child does something bad, they take away something that is important to the child. And if that's the way that the United States, the current foreign policy, thinks that it can deal with a country like Russia, like that we're in the parental role and that we can scold them and take away their toys when they don't do what we say, that's just completely divorced from reality of the past 100 years and the several hundred years before that. So I think it's important to keep in mind that over the, like, since the fall of the Soviet Union, at a certain point, there was a fork in the road. And would we continue on, like, is our 60-year vision or our 600-year vision let's go 600 years in the future. I would like to imagine that in 600 years, we would have a moon base and we are possibly a Mars base by that point, right? And if we can imagine that the U.S., we would hope so, right? And if we had a moon base and we had, for example, the United States had a modular nuclear reactor that we sent to the moon to start a base. When we envision that potential future way in the distance, is it a joint cooperation with China? Is it a joint cooperation with Russia, similar to the International Space Station? Is it a joint cooperation with Europe?
I
would hope so.
It's the Star Trek future. It's
something to dream towards together, so we could move collectively in the future, even though you may have conflict today. It's in a way, it's no different than how you would set up your relationship with your spouse. You have goals in 6 months. You have goals in 6 years. You have goals when your kids graduate. You have goals for retirement. And it's those goals that keep you from leaving or from escalating conflict in the present. There will be conflict in the present, but it's the shared vision towards the future that can get you through those things. So the absence of that shared vision in the future is to be quite frank, dangerous. And we seem to have this irrational perspective for how we expect the Russian culture and the Russian autocratic dictator, right, to respond. And let me give a quick example. Russia, the Russian culture has a collective trauma from what occurred during World War II, when they lost about 1 in 3 of their able-bodied men through an invasion from the Nazis. And if you go approximately 100 years before that, they had a similar issue with the invasion of Napoleon. There's a certain amount of cultural paranoia that is baked into the cultural fabric of the country. And it even goes back before that, back to when you just had the principalities of Moscow and the principalities of Kiev with a basic relationship, and they were dealing with invasions from Mongol hordes to the east. And I believe it was Vikings to the west and the north. So the culture in Russia has always been about protecting the heartland of Russia, Moscow area, and expanding the borders out as far as possible. And Ukraine roughly translates to borderland. And if you look at the strategy that worked for them in both the Napoleonic times and the Nazi times, the strategy was, look, we may be outgunned, but if we hold our positions as far back as possible and dig in, and this happens around where Ukraine is, and we dig in, then when they overwhelm our lines, we retreat 50 kilometers or 150 kilometers. And along the way, we burn everything to the ground. We burn all resources to the ground. And then we dig in again. And then they repeat the process going back until hopefully stalling the enemy until winter comes to save them. And that's the intentional strategy that they execute. But the reason why I highlight those components from the Napoleonic era and from the Hitler invasion is because culturally they're okay with burning Ukraine to the ground, if it means that it doesn't, if it means that they're not giving up a geopolitical strategic position to who they perceive to be their enemies, and enemies being a military threat along their border. And if you understand that paranoia, even if you don't disagree, even if you don't agree with it, it's not our culture. We don't get to tell them what is baked into the fabric of their culture. If you understand that, we may tread with more caution in pushing our NATO bases and military force presence directly to their perceived borders. And the example that I always give is, imagine if Mexico signed a security pact with China, and then China decided that because of that security pact, they would be establishing military bases or missiles that could strike the U.S. from their allied territory in Mexico. We don't have to go far back. Like, the Cuban Missile Crisis shows an example of how we would respond, and we would risk thermonuclear war to prevent that from happening. So it just seems like the foreign policy right now is dictated by children who lack a basic comprehension of the complexity of the situation.
You see it precisely the way I do. And I heard in your interview with Jim Breslow that you have a little bit of a libertarian streak. And my political kind of North Star is Ron Paul. And I'm essentially a non-interventionist. That's different from a pacifist. I am not a pacifist, but we involve ourselves in things that I don't think that we should. And it creates animosity towards the United States throughout the globe. And the thing that concerned me a lot about this initially is this push by NATO and these hints and things that we were giving to Ukraine. And now we're in this conflagration, and the U.S., instead of trying to help mediate the situation and get Russia and Ukraine possibly, I say possibly, to a table where we could talk about this, instead we immediately sided with Ukraine, and we start talking about giving them weapons and things, and I think we just gave them some more, and we've given them billions and billions of dollars, possibly, arguably, prolonging this tragedy. So, I don't know, I would have liked to have seen the United States act more as a attempted mediator than taking a side in this. And my personal feelings about this and the policy of the show is I stand with the people of both Ukraine and Russia. So I stand with the people.
I agree with you 100%. And about a week after all of these things were starting, about 2 weeks, somewhere in the 1 week, 2 week range, I wrote for a friend of mine who works for one of the three letter agencies. And I wrote what was essentially was my fan fiction of what I think the optimal solution to mitigate the damage to the peoples on both sides would actually be, because they're actually brother peoples.
Yes.
They, when they were within the Soviet Union, they had a relationship like California has to Arizona, right? There was intermixing between the people. Almost all families in Moscow have a family member that's in Ukraine, and all in Kiev specifically. And most and vice versa. So that's important to keep in mind. And so in this fan fiction, through my historical prism and my Catholic background, if you look through that throughout the Middle Ages, one of the functions of the church was as a mediator, right? I'm really glad you focused in on that word, was because the church doesn't really have a standing army. Their power came a lot from their ability to negotiate and to mediate the disputes with regards to who should be the true king in these different regions. So what I really would have liked to see, and this is something that I would have given Biden accolades for if he'd actually done this, would be if Biden had flown out to the Vatican and had a conversation with the Pope and use that influence. So there's a patriarch the Roman Catholic Church and the Eastern Orthodox Church are siblings, cousins, that, with a common ancestor back in the past. And the people in Ukraine and the people in Russia are very heavily influenced by the Eastern Orthodox Church. Mm-hmm. And if we could have arranged a situation on our end, right? Meaning our end, meaning us and our allies in Ukraine, where the Patriarch of Kiev from the Eastern Orthodox Church invited the Patriarch of Rome to represent the people outside of Ukraine. And then the Patriarch of Kiev represented the people within Ukraine and invited the Patriarch of Moscow for a joint summit on neutral territory. And they each invited their respective heads of state, right? Biden representing the rest of the world, Zelensky representing Kiev, and Putin to represent the interests of the state of Russia. You could have driven a wedge between the people of Russia and Putin. And what we did, like, so my counterfactual scenario didn't come to pass. And what we effectively did was play into the propaganda war that that Putin was using to describe us, or to describe Ukraine, as puppets of the United States. And that propaganda has strengthened his ties with the people of Russia and driven a wedge between the people of Russia and the people of Ukraine.
It has been lose-lose on all fronts. Daniel, exactly. I've got to take a quick break. I'm speaking with Daniel Martinez. He's U.S. Congressional Candidate, District 31. This is TNT Deprogram. We'll be right back.
The midterms and America votes on November 8th. With his expert analysis and opinion, this is TNT Radio's Jeremy Beck.
In this midterm election season, the establishment legacy media is very focused on what they call the big lie. To them, the big lie is not that COVID vaccines are safe and effective, or that NATO is fighting to save democracy in Ukraine. Oh no, the big lie to them is that Trump actually won the 2020 presidential election. For elections that have been called so far this primary season, 105 candidates who outright dispute the result of the 2020 election and 42 candidates who have questioned the results have won the Republican nomination out of 284 nominees in total. This means that 52% of the GOP nominees so far endorsed the so-called big lie in some way. But maybe it's the other way around, and there is evidence of widespread electoral fraud. I'll let you be the judge. I'm Jeremy Beck for TNT Radio.
The possibility of lung cancer can be pretty scary, especially if you're one of approximately 8 million current or former smokers at high risk. That's why SaveByTheScan.org wants you to know that now there's a breakthrough low-dose CT scan that can detect lung cancer early, and it only takes 60 seconds. You stop smoking, now start screening. For an easy quiz to see if you're eligible, visit SaveByTheScan.org. It could save your life. SaveByTheScan.org is brought to you by the American Lung Association's Lung Force Initiative and the Ad Council.
Instead of putting a cracker under a politician, why not some TNT? Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
This is our final segment with Daniel Martinez. He is running here in California, U.S. congressional candidate as a Republican. And so the Ukraine thing, I mean, this has been a tragedy. I say mediate because that was the first thing I thought of. I mean, why are we not mediating this? And we did play directly into all of the pre-existing stereotypes and profiling that could have been applied to us. And now the people of Ukraine have had their country largely decimated. And I don't see a winner per se on either side, because both sides have taken heavy losses and the country of Ukraine's had its infrastructure decimated. Both sides have lost a lot of people. And we as Americans, I just want to ask my government in the future, let's not interfere. Let's try to get people to the treaty table or to the mediation table. That's an obvious thing. Oh, let me just throw one other thing in. It's just that when this first began, and I would speak to family and friends about this, who were very fired up by the media talking about Putin being insane. I'm like, look, you may not agree with him. I do not think the man's insane at all. And then I had other friends say, well, you know, somebody on their side has to assassinate him. And I'm like, well, think that through. Okay. It's like, I don't think that's an easy thing to do. And what you're calling for radically destabilizes the global situation. So, I mean, all of this could have been avoided.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead. Also based off of a fiction and a dream that whoever replaces Putin would be less harsh and more stable and more pro-Western than Putin, right? And there's just no evidence to indicate that that's the case, right? Like, we really need to remove everybody who's been making these decisions up until this point, because they seem to have no comprehension of how of this pattern that's repeated itself, right? It's similar to what happened in Crimea. And in 2012, there were huge amounts of natural gas deposits were discovered in Ukraine. And I think on a very, very shallow, narrow-minded approach, this dream popped into somebody's head where it was like, hey, you know what? If we were to be able to fully integrate Ukraine into NATO and in the EU, and then have Western companies fully develop out those fields, then we could be in a situation where we could just flip a switch and completely cut off the natural gas dependency from Russia to Europe, which produces almost nothing. Most of it comes from Netherlands, and they're just turning off their fields. So it seems like that idea was like that simplistic idea was like, oh, let's just do that, thinking that Russia wouldn't respond. And a very
as if that
thing happened
as if that wouldn't yeah. occur to Russia.
Yeah, I see really two main reasons for why they took Crimea. And one of them was the discovery of all of these different natural gas deposits, because if they have Crimea and the natural gas deposits are within that exclusive economic zone, then they have the ability to develop those. Crimea had the additional complication because they also have it's also the only warm water port that their Black Sea fleet, which is their nuclear capable fleet, has access to, like a warm water port that they have access to all year long. So from the perspective of the Russians, I heard a special ops guy on the local radio, Brian Suits, talking about this back in 2008, before the invasion of Crimea, explaining that that the Black Sea port, from their standpoint, is one leg of their nuclear triad, and they're not letting it go. It would be the fact that Ukraine wants to keep it is comparable to Cuba wanting to keep their territorial integrity with regards to the basic Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. They send us a letter every single year asking us to vacate their property. And we disregard that completely because we don't care. We're the dominant superpower in the region that has multiple nuclear weapons. And it's a strategic value to us. And that's the only thing that matters from our perspective. And the Russians behave quite similarly. It's just irrational for us to believe that we're somehow in this parent-child relationship with them, that we can scold them into doing. That's so antithetical to the strength that the Russian people crave, given their history of being invaded by outsiders.
It is the condescending attitude that the rest of the world has against the U.S. And a lot has happened since the last election, and I can't really point to a lot. And listen, I want to give Biden accolades. I want to find, he's my president too. I didn't vote for him, but he's my president. So I want to support the guy. I want to give him praise or accolades where I can, but just so many things have gone wrong, and this has just been an absolute tragedy. Let's get away from that. So in our remaining minutes, Daniel, because, man, I'm pulling for you, brother. So I want you to impart to my audience in the 7 or 8 minutes we have left, everything we need to know about Daniel Martinez and why you should be elected.
Yeah, well, so what you were saying before, my roots are libertarian. I switched my party registration to be a Republican because the National Party wasn't interested in challenging the race, even though the incumbent was 86 years old, right? So I'm a first generation Hispanic, and it's a 60% Hispanic district. I speak fluent Spanish. When I was in law school, I took classes with Justice Scalia for separation of powers and statutory interpretation. And so I'm the living embodiment of the dream, the American dream for the Hispanic community. So I am the candidate that can take this seat away from essentially Nancy Pelosi. And I would like to close similar, and I hope this is not the last time you have me. I hope this is the first time.
No, I'd love to have you on because I'm and we're going to meet tonight in person.
And I'm really looking forward to it. But I would, since we only have a couple of minutes left, I very much this is would like to close in the same way that I opened, in that so many of our problems right now, it's because of, it honestly seems like I'm looking at a schizophrenic that's running around in circles. And if you look at that schizophrenic more closely, they're not actually running around in circles. Their attention is flickering every few seconds from different topic to different topic to different topic. So it appears that they're running around in circles. The psychological treatment solution for that is to get the person to calm down and then to focus their intention on the horizon in 6 months, or in their case, maybe 6 days, and then six right. weeks, and then 6 months, and then 60 years, right? But as a country, we need to have that long-term trajectory, because throughout the Cold War, we had more cooperation with Russia and the space program than we do today. And we're moving in the wrong direction on those things, because during the 90s, and this is something that Bill Clinton should get some credit for, was that the idea behind the International Space Station was having a long-term trajectory and a dream that we both could work towards, and having those mutual members of our respective militaries sitting next to each other in the vacuum of space required us to have a certain amount of communication that could prevent a thermonuclear catastrophe. And so if there's any point that I think a lot of our problems would go away from the energy, I mean, would come into focus what a rational solution would be from the energy bridge that we need to get to whatever our future energy source is, to the situation in Crimea and Russia, and hopefully what we can avoid with China and Taiwan, if we can have a 60-year plan and a 600-year plan and keep focused on those goals. So then we know what to do in the present to be able to get there.
I like all of that. And in the 80s and the early 90s, when you would see the Soyuz link up with the space station and the space shuttle would be there, these kind of symbolic things and personalities of particular humans can affect the actual national psyche. And these are the kinds of things that help. These are positive things. And we need to return to that. And the incredible divisiveness and tribalism that is what we're in right now. I mean, you know, and I fall into it too. I'm not going to lie. I don't like it, but we need vision. We need optimism. And the constant us, them fighting back and forth and negativity, and like this thing in Ukraine, we should have mediated that. We had a moment where perhaps we could have taken the power of the United States, possibly in tandem with the Vatican, as you've announced or put forth, and tried to mediate what has become a major crisis. And instead, what we're really looking at is another potential crisis in China and Taiwan. And this is where the U.S. should step up. But I don't see these people being capable of doing that.
Yeah, I don't think these people, I mean, I think the religious side of the angle and the influence that it has on all the different peoples and the unifying element that it has on the peoples, given their shared, their common history, I don't think they think this way. I just don't think that thought ever crossed their mind. And as a contrast from the last administration, I want to focus on the Abraham Accords, because I don't think people talk about this enough. The Abraham Accords did more for the reduction of Middle East in the medium term. And again, it's one of those plans that was a 60-year plan. There was a domestic price to be paid by all of the different parties that joined. But just the fact that the name was chosen based off of the Abrahamic common ground between the Islamic faith and the Christian faith. It's just a brilliant way to get people to focus on the commonality between them. We all want clean water. We all want, you mentioned this earlier, we're all environmentalists, right? We all want clean water for our kids. We all want healthy food for our kids. We all want our kids to have a better future than we had. And if we start from that shared perspective 60 years in the future, that's what we would like to build. And hopefully we can construct our future where our children aren't throwing rocks at each other or nuclear weapons at each other. That seems like a worthwhile thing to aim for. And it doesn't seem like this concept exists in the mind of the people that are currently running the country.
I've been speaking with Daniel Martinez. You can find him at danmartinezforcongress.com. And Daniel, I wish you the best of luck. I look forward to meeting you tonight. I'd love to have you back because we talked about so many things. I mean, you actually were able to study a bit under Scalia. So we'll have to talk about that. Maybe you can come back in a week or so because we got a lot of Supreme Court things to talk about. And I wish you the best of luck. And I look forward to seeing you tonight.
Likewise.
Fantastic. All right, folks, so we're going to take a quick break. This is TNT Deprogram. We'll be back on the other side, and we're going to talk about a new film that premieres tonight. We'll be back.